Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me on the Slice of Healthcare podcast. I'm your co-host, Jared Taylor, and I'm joined with my co-host, Layla Yari. On the episode today, we have Dr. Linda Anagawa, the Chief Medical Officer of Noom. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me, Jared and Layla. It's really wonderful to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So Dr. Linda, let's jump in. We'd love to hear about your background, what kind of medicine you studied, and your background in work, and what led you to come to Noom.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is actually very traditional primary care internal medicine. So teaching at the bedside, students and residents, patient care of, you know, a historically very underserved population with high medical needs. And while I absolutely loved what I did, and I loved those connections with the patients, what I grew very frustrated with was every single time the patient would come back to see us in the clinic, they would be sicker, inevitably, no matter what they were doing. They would have worsening labs. They would need more medication for their chronic diseases. They would be following up from an emergency room visit, having had like a heart attack or a stroke or a flare of chronic back pain. And it really started to baffle me how few solutions we really had for our patients and how rigid and inflexible our healthcare system really was, despite the obvious, you know, that we're supposed to be doing all this to get people better and it simply wasn't working. So this is kind of funny, but I randomly discovered obesity medicine by accident when I was moonlighting in a hospital bariatric clinic to cover for my colleague who wanted more time at his kids' soccer games on the weekends. And I was blown away with what I saw in bariatric medicine. Now, granted, these were patients who had had bariatric surgery, and I'm a huge supporter of bariatric surgery. I think it's a phenomenally important intervention, but it did also get me thinking, is there a way that we can create some of these metabolic effects non-surgically? Like, is there a possible way to do this with nutrition, medical treatment, you know, for those who don't qualify for surgery or who prefer not to have a surgery? And so that led me down this obesity medicine journey, went to my first Obesity Medicine Association meeting. I heard Eric Westman speak from the Duke Lifestyle Medicine Center about nutritional interventions for metabolic health. And like, I think I rushed the stage after that talk, like I was at a Metallica concert or something, you know, like total fangirl, because I was blown away with what I was hearing. And so I started treating patients utilizing an obesity medicine framework, taking into account patients' entire histories, not just their medical history and what diseases they'd been diagnosed with, but what was their weight like? Did they have a history of trauma? What was their relationship to food? What's the earliest time point where they remembered weight, like coming into their consciousness? Did they get teased about their weight? Was puberty a problem? For women, was pregnancy an issue? Did they return to their baseline weight? As an adult, did they tend to yo-yo? Did they follow lots of different diets? Did they experience a lot of emotional distress over weight? What were their cravings like? You know, is it more cyclical, like related to menstrual cycles? Is it tied to emotion? There's so much to explore, really, and there's so much to address. And, you know, got deeper and deeper into obesity medicine treatment and started from there building programs for a variety of different entities, including a digital primary care firm called PlushCare And following that, Noom reached out to me a few years down the road, and I've now been with the company since December of 2022.
That's amazing. It's an incredible background. Thank you for sharing the long story. What do you think is happening with obesity today from your perspective, being deep in the trenches? And where do you think is more impacted by this problem in the country and is getting harder to manage?
Yeah. You know, as glad as I am to see all of the attention that is now being showered on the disease of obesity, like it's kind of a chronic condition that has kind of been in the shadows forever and ever, you know, compared to things like diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, and heart disease. So it's now coming to the surface and is the subject of lots of discussion, but it is still an epidemic and it has tremendous ripple effects in our communities because we're still heading in the wrong direction. So we know that over 40% of people in the United States suffer from obesity. We know that 70% have either obesity or what I call pre-obesity. So we used to call people either having overweight or having obesity. The reason why in obesity medicine we prefer the term pre-obesity rather is because it kind of sheds light on the fact that this is a progressive problem. So if you have pre-obesity, you are very, very likely to progress in the wrong direction without intervention. And currently, what really gets me is only 8 states in the United States right now remain with an obesity rate of less than 30%. And 10 years ago, that number was 41 states. So we've gone from 41 states, and now we've dropped all the way down to only 8 states that have that obesity rate of less than 30%. And these states are disproportionately in the southern part of the country. And people of color living in these states are also disproportionately affected. Now, the caveat to these numbers, of course, this all goes by self-reported weight and BMI. It's not a perfect barometer, of course, of overall health, but we do know that if you have weight-related disease, treating the excess weight prevents further complications and reduces the long-term risk of any disorders that an individual might have currently.
That's an absolutely incredible statistic that I think everybody should know. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. What do you think about the state of food in the nation and optionality for folks to live a nutritious lifestyle?
I think it's really tough. You know, we know that so many communities where obesity is especially prevalent are affected by the food desert problem, where there isn't the availability of fresh, nutritious foods, and there's an overabundance of, you know, fast food joints and stores that sell only prepackaged processed foods. So without a doubt, it is a huge, huge contributor. I think that the other thing that we also struggle with is that there's really not a lot of great education around nutrition. And part of that stems from the problem, the fundamental problem of nutritional research being very flawed. And one of the reasons why our nutritional research is so flawed is because we often rely on things like food frequency questionnaires to try to get an idea of what people are eating and correlate that to specific health metrics. But the problem with a food frequency questionnaire is you have to rely on people's recall of not just what they ate yesterday. I mean, I can barely remember what I ate yesterday, but some of the research we have relies on recall from many months or even years ago. You know, there was this one study that I read recently where they were looking at servings of dairy consumed by individuals on a daily basis over many years. I mean, I don't know how many times I drank milk in, you know, 2005. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but this is the type of flawed data that I think has unfortunately informed a lot of our policy making. And it's all really quite antiquated and needs to be revisited.
That's very interesting. And what do you, let's jump into practices around weight loss. What do you think in your position, again, being in the trenches, what are the best practices around weight loss to date?
You know, I think the number one most important thing to keep in mind with respect to best practices is that obesity is a nuanced disorder with a wide variety of influencing factors, from genetics to environment to behaviors to epigenetics to, you know, your economic situation and whether you do live in a food desert, right? So each patient has to be approached as an individual. If you try to treat obesity as a one-size-fits-all problem, you're really not going to get very far. So individualization and personalization, I think, is absolutely a best practice. And then I'll add on to that, which is a comprehensive care plan is also very, very important. There's no silver bullet. There's no one drug. There's no one surgery. There's no one diet or any single intervention that is gonna make a dent alone. And I think it's actually very analogous to what we know about the treatment of other chronic diseases. You know, I can give people Crestor for their cholesterol, but if I'm gonna subsist on a diet of French fries and donuts, the Crestor won't be nearly as effective for my cholesterol as it would be if I'm including avocados and salmon and plenty of salad greens and so on. So personalization and comprehensive care, I would say, are definitely best practices.
And we talked a bit about this before we started the show, but mental health, anxiety, all the different elements that kind of go into eating, eating habits, like what can you share on that front? Because sometimes it's not even that people are hungry, they're just, they have anxiety or they have different disorders that kind of drive them to food. And it would be interesting. And then some of it is the genetic factors or, you know, the other things that kind of go into it, that go into that personalization.
Yeah, I think it's such a key point, Layla. I mean, among patients that I have treated for the disease of obesity, I would estimate that anywhere between 30 and 40% of individuals have some type of an untreated mood disorder, be it depression, anxiety, premenstrual dysphoria, menopause-associated depression and anxiety. And you're absolutely right that, you know, if we don't feel good about ourselves, if we don't feel like we have a strong sense of self-efficacy, if we struggle with low moods, if we have a tremendous amount of inertia, you know, to incorporate movement into our life, absolutely it's going to affect our weight. And as we gain weight and feel more uncomfortable in our bodies, it can actually further that spiral. So, you know, there's data that show that with weight loss and health improvements, we do also see improvement in emotional health. You know, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I don't know that that's so important, but I think it also does speak to the need for us to really assess our patients carefully and assess mood, assess sense of well-being. Are people impacted by anxiety? Do they have insomnia, which is often a very, very common symptom of underlying anxiety? That needs to be treated just as much if we're gonna have impact on metabolic health. There's actually a whole new interesting field emerging as well within psychiatry called metabolic psychiatry, which focuses on the role of nutrition, not just in weight loss and mitigation of traditional cardiovascular risk factors, but also as an approach to mental health and even preservation of memory and prevention of dementia as we age. So, you know, this idea of mind-body separation as we treat weight, I think is something that we're starting to dismantle.
I want to spend some time talking. Layla and I just got this episode's being recorded fresh after Vive, and we talked a little bit about in the beginning of our conversation before we started recording how, you know, at Health last year, it seemed like AI was the major topic of discussion, and AI was still very much the topic of discussion at Vive this year, but right up there, maybe even a little more, it was GLP-1s that, as Layla said earlier in our conversation before we started recording, everyone's trying to figure out how do they integrate GLP-1s into really anything that they're doing in the space today. So I'd love to spend some time now talking more about that. And can you talk us through like what suggestions you have for these companies in learning how to integrate a GLP-1 offering into their company?
And first off, we'd also actually really like to ask you what you think about GLP-1s and the history of drugs coming to the market. What is your take? Do you think it's one of the best drugs that's come to the market in a long time? Do you think it's one of the most dangerous drugs? Like, if you can just start with what you think about the medication in itself first, and then what advice you have for these companies that are all contemplating whether or not they should offer this to their customers and their patients.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think for those of us who have been in obesity medicine for a while, GLP-1s really represent a tremendously exciting advance in, you know, the care of individuals with obesity. I can't say most of us are deeply surprised because, you know, the first early GLP-1s were actually FDA approved for type 2 diabetes almost 20 years ago now. And when we started to identify that these medications did have weight losing properties in individuals who took them, we started using them, you know, exactly for that purpose. A lot of times on label, you know, for individuals with type 2 diabetes and obesity, but often off label as well, just because we didn't have a large amount of therapeutic options. Like the way I almost think about it is like, you know, obesity is kind of like where hypertension was in the 1970s, right? So we knew that high blood pressure was dangerous and it had adverse health consequences. There were just a smattering of drugs starting to become available, but like, you know, we weren't that familiar or comfortable with them and they weren't being used that often. So same thing with obesity, right? So we know it creates long-term health complications, starting to have a few drugs out there, but, you know, how to actually go about treatment and coming up with those algorithms was a little bit difficult. So having these new branded options for weight loss is really tremendous. It is without a doubt a generational advance. And I think we're really just at the tip of the iceberg of where this drug class is going to go. We're going to start to see more effective medications. We're going to start to see combination drugs that can help mitigate some of the side effects and prolong the action of the drugs. We're going to start to see drugs that target multiple different pathways, right? Because one of the best ways to fight back against weight plateaus and metabolic adaptation is really to do more than just hit one metabolic pathway in the body. So absolutely, we've needed these medications for a long time. Now, I will say that to be the most successful with the use of these medications, behavior change is really critical. Medications can't do this on their own. Like, you know, I tell people as a doctor, I've actually put people on Wegovy, for example, and watch them gain weight. It can really happen. Nobody believes me, but I've absolutely seen that.
How does that happen that they go on there and then they end up putting on weight?
Yeah, well, a lot of different ways. So the first is if you're not incorporating the right nutrition with a GLP-1, you could be maximizing the wrong pharmacologic bucket of effects. So the way I like to think about it is this: there's two sort of main buckets of effects of these drugs. I'm a pharmacologist also, so I'm going to nerd out for just a second on you. So the first is the bucket of effects that increases insulin secretion from the pancreas. That's why these drugs were developed for type 2 diabetes. And then the second bucket of effects involve the drug's effect on appetite. So slowing gastric emptying and signaling the brain to reduce hunger and cravings. Now, when you increase insulin secretion, insulin is actually a fat storage hormone. So that's something that we don't want. And that gets enhanced even more with GLP-1s when we eat starches, so carbohydrates. So if you eat a very carbohydrate-rich diet with a GLP-1, theoretically speaking, you could be maximizing the insulin-secreting effects, which reinforce fat storage. Okay, so you could be taking this drug and not really getting the right effect. Now, the second way that I've seen people gain weight on these medications, and this is something that's been very important to us at Noom, is that people don't take them consistently, either due to poor access or improper side effect management. So they might take the drug for a little bit, lose weight, and then come off the drug for a period of time, right? We know when you lose weight with the GLP-1s, or you lose weight by any method, you're going to lose fat, but you're also going to lose muscle. Okay. When you gain the weight back, what do you think you're gaining back? It's not the muscle, right? I mean, unless you're like Arnold Schwarzenegger and you're pumping iron 5 hours a day, right? We're going to gain back fat. So over time, our body composition can erode and we can wind up in worse shape and in worse health than before. There's actually a condition called sarcopenic obesity, which means low muscle mass in combination with obesity. And the mortality rate of individuals with sarcopenia is way, way higher. You're actually better off having the obesity alone in the first place when it comes to the overall impact on your health span and your longevity. It's that much of a danger. So, you know, I think to kind of like to get to the second part of the question, Jared, you know, when it comes to how should a program be structured, you know, Noom's point of view is really that the long-term behavior change is absolutely critical. You've got to have support in place to help people make the right food choices while they're taking the drugs. You've got to have the right type of guidance on exercise, physical activity, and movement to maintain that muscle mass. And when you have all of that in place, plus you're able to shift mindset through a combination of working with a coach as well as a finely honed product that gives you those behavioral nudges when you need it the most, that's the way I think to really maximize the promise of these prescriptions.
But once you take it, like, do you have to be on it? Like, here's what I hear from the average person walking down the street that hears about it, right? They're like, I think once you take that, you can never stop taking it, or then you gain all the weight back. Like, that is what you hear if you go up to someone and say, with these new weight loss drugs that you hear about, what's the rumor? Well, if you go off it, you gain all the weight back. Is there truth to that? Like, also, we'd love to hear your
yes. Take. Let's talk about that. I absolutely love this topic. I'll start out by saying that our data are pretty slim on this to begin with, because the drugs are relatively new. Now, the study that you'll hear quoted most often in this regard is the Step 1 study extension done by the makers of the medication, in which they withdrew the medication from individuals who had very, very minimal lifestyle support, and there was significant weight gain. To me, I don't think that's any surprise, right? It's no different than if you had bariatric surgery and didn't incorporate the kinds of healthy eating and the exercise and the psychological change that's needed for long-term success. What we know about Noom, which I think gives us a very, very unique opportunity when paired with GLP-1s, 75% of Noom users who complete the weight program without any medication, they maintain at least 5% weight loss 12 months later, and half maintained 10% weight loss after a year. So that is a really tremendous result. And I think when you combine the intensive lifestyle program that's offered through a company like Noom and you pair it with these drugs, I think that's where we have potential really to off-ramp people from medications and yet have them maintain the weight that they lost. Now, does that apply to every single patient on a GLP-1? No. And, you know, like I said before, we really have to think about each patient as an individual. There are certainly folks who have high-risk obesity. Perhaps they've undergone bariatric surgery, and then after that, they've experienced a wide swing of weight regain. Or like anybody who's yo-yoed a lot and who's experienced that erosion of body composition. Somebody who's got high-risk medical disease, like let's say they've got type 2 diabetes with eye and kidney disease, for example. So some of these types of individuals, I can certainly see it as being desirable to keep them on a GLP-1 through the longer term. But I think we still have a lot to learn about off-ramping, and it's obviously a very active area of study here at Noom with our research team.
Dr. Anagawa, I'd like to go back to something that you mentioned before we started the podcast about the Google searches around nutritions and diets and how that's kind of gone down. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what's super interesting is that as search trends have gone up for Ozempic, and you know, you can do this yourself on the Google Trends search and, you know, put in whatever terms you like. So you'll see over the last couple of years that the term Ozempic has really skyrocketed. At the same time, the searches for specific diets that were all the rage before, like keto or low calorie or paleo or South Beach and others, have taken a total nosedive. You know, I think you can interpret this in one of two ways. The first, I guess, the more, you know, kind of cynical way to interpret it is that, oh, people think they don't need to change their eating. They just think they can get the drug and all will be well. I'm not sure I actually interpret it that way. I see this as people looking to incorporate the medication with a more holistic way of viewing nutrition and their body. And perhaps rather than looking to a specific restrictive diet pattern, maybe to embracing a more holistic way of eating. You know, like one of the huge benefits of the GLP-1s is for individuals who really suffer from addictive eating patterns. You might have heard about people describing food noise, where they just constantly think about food, even if their stomach is full. One of the major benefits of these drugs is by cutting out the food noise in people's brains, they can really start to get more in tune with their body's own sensation of hunger and fullness once and for all, and finally embrace a more holistic way of eating. So, yeah, so that's my, you know, maybe slightly Pollyanna-ish and optimistic way of viewing that and my hope for the future.
And there is something called intuitive eating. I think there's a doctor out of UCLA who specializes on that, but it's like how to embrace intuitive eating and listening to your body and getting through that food noise, as you just mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, the intuitive eating conversation is something that I find particularly fascinating because on the one hand, does intuitive eating mean that when my brain tells me I need a half a gallon of ice cream, that I should go and eat that? You know, is that really intuitive eating? I'm not so certain, you know, about that, especially if you feel worse and, you know, you beat yourself up afterwards, right? That's obviously not a desired outcome. But if we can be more in touch with the physical sensations of our body and feel like we have some sense of control and responsiveness, then I think that's highly desirable.
Right. So we have to ask, what do you think will end the obesity epidemic? Good question.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I don't think will end it. I certainly don't think GLP-1s alone are going to end it. I think that a combination of different types of treatment, I think taking a long, hard look at how we are set up as a society to foster well-being for people in our homes, in our communities, in our workspaces, in our schools. You know, it's estimated right now that 1 in 4 children today will develop type 2 diabetes and metabolic disease as a result of weight, and the generation is not expected to outlive their parents. So I think, you know, intervening when kids are still kids, making sure that they have access to healthy, fresh food, make sure that their families are empowered to help them make those choices, make sure that schools foster environments that are conducive to metabolic health. You know, there's so much work that needs to be done. And I think ultimately it's going to involve partnerships between, you know, private companies, public entities, education, the food industry, and health professionals as well.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I have to tell you, it's been such an incredible, lovely conversation. And I think people are going to be really excited to hear this episode. And thank you again.
Likewise, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And if you want to throw us the affiliate link for that backdrop so you just see the cash rolling in after this episode, because everyone's going to want one, you send it to us. We put it in the link. We'll do that for you. Thanks so much. We really had a fun time on this conversation.